Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's broadcast brings you authors Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, authors of Portrait of a Monster. More about them and their book in just a few minutes. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the unflappable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron is an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director, publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and his in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out next year, and this summer he'll publish another book about the famous Gonzales shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Always a great promo. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like hot tamales in Guadalajara in Mexico. Thanks for that, Ronnie. This week's show brings you Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, authors of Portrait of a Monster, the story of the sordid life of Joran Vandersloot, convicted killer, and the Natalie Holloway mystery. In May 2005, Natalie Holloway disappeared from a high school trip to Aruba. 5 years to the day later, 21-year-old Stephanie Flores was reported missing in Lima. Implicated in both crimes was one young man, Joran Vandersloot. I'll tell you, Ronnie, it's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure.
Right.
Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag, I just want to thank all our listeners for tuning in. You know, we're right on track. We get 130,000 listeners every week now from over 100 countries. So it's really really something to wave the flag about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making this show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their music as our theme song. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, now here is this week's mailbag. This one is from Peter of Salem, Alabama. He writes, "Your show last week with Noam Chomsky was over the top. How did you get this guy to come on your show? I've been an admirer of his for 50 years. It's a shame the mainstream media doesn't cover him more." Now, this one is from Marcel of Nice, France, all the way from France, who writes, "Here in France, we have a tradition in revering social activists. It's a shame that the U.S. government foreign policy doesn't take a page from Dr. Chomsky's views on getting involved in needless wars like Afghanistan and Iraq. I applaud Dr. Chomsky's wisdom and intelligence." Any remarks to that, Ronnie?
Yeah, how do we get Dr. Chomsky? Well, we ask. I mean, that's what journalists do, and all we can do is say
simple
no.
Simple as
right?
that. Yeah.
So
yeah,
right, if you've been turned down as a prom, for prom date, you know. you know how it feels. So it's something that you have practice with. But it was a great pleasure to have Dr. Chomsky on, and his mind at 85 is just amazing to watch him, the way it operates and the way he answers some of the questions. And I know our ratings went up hugely, and that's amazing since he's all but shut out of the corporate media and mainstream media on that.
Absolutely.
So it was a real honor to have him on the show.
You bet, and that show is archived, so anybody who's missed it could tune in anytime. It was a fascinating interview. Well, Ronnie, I hear you're going up to New York City, the big, bad, Big Apple, to the Museum of American Gangster on, that's next week, April the 11th,
to premiere
your new documentary. Tell us, our listeners, about that.
Yeah, right. We're going to premiere our documentary at the Museum of American Gangster, one of the best-kept secrets in New York City, and I'm bringing Ike Atkinson with me, who's the subject of my book, Sergeant Smack, which has been optioned for a movie, and so people that want to attend will be able to meet Ike and see the documentary, and we'll talk about the whole black gangster scene from the 1970s, and a real fascinating chapter in American gangster history. And go to the website, frankmatthewsmovie.com, for more information about it.
Yeah, that's going to be an exciting event. I wish I was in the neck of the woods so I could go up there. But best of luck to that, Ronnie. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please.
Right. We got two great authors this week, and the hits just keep on coming. We got Chris Kyle, author of American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. history. And this book has been a bestseller, I think, for the last 5 or 6 months. New York Times, Amazon, wherever you go. It's number one, and I've seen him interviewed, and usually it's like 5 to 10 minutes, but we're going to spend 35, 40 minutes on and get into the psychology of the sniper and what's involved and all that sort of thing. So it's going to be a great show.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that one. It's a fascinating story. It's an autobiography, and he's going to be a great guest. Now, thanks for that. Just a reminder, after our broadcast tonight, Ron and I will join Nancy on the Chit-Chat Cafe just after 9 p.m. Lisa, her partner, is on the co-host, is on assignment in Spain. So now back to our show. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here's this week's rap sheet item. Dateline, March 27th, New York City. Shooting death of Florida teenager brings national outrage. Hey, Ronnie, the recent killing of Trayvon Martin needs more investigation. But where's the outrage over the daily scourge of black-on-black crime? I'll tell you, Ronnie, this is the shooting death of Martin in Florida has sparked national outrage, with civil rights leaders from San Francisco to New York leading protests calling for a new investigation and the arrest of the shooter. Hey, what's your take on this?
Well, you can't get away from this story. It's been everywhere. They've covered every angle, but the angle that you mentioned has not been covered yet. But it's a real serious situation. Last week we talked to Dr. Chomsky. One of every two black males will be in jail by 2020. That's one out of every two black males in the United States will have spent time in prison. And I just saw a statistic today on CNN where if you have a white and a black convicted of a drug offense, the black alleged perpetrator is more likely to, 10 times more likely to go to jail than the white alleged perpetrator. So it's a real serious thing, and I think that we need more programs in the inner city, job training, after school programs, to try to arrest this disturbing trend. And,
absolutely,
we're not spending our money where it's supposed to be, Willie.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's a big problem, and the authorities and the U.S. government have to get onto this because it's a national shame, as far as I'm concerned. Now, just before we get on,
well, I should add, I also wear a hoodie too. So
you're part of
you
the
know,
game.
So right? I don't think that has anything to do with crime.
No. Well, anyway, it's an intriguing and very fascinating story, and hopefully they get their act together. Now, just before we get on with our featured guests, Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on its internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, you could email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guests tonight are Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, authors of the best-selling book titled Portrait of a Monster. Tonight, we'll discuss the sensational and riveting case of convicted murderer Jorn Vandersloot and Natalie Holloway mystery. Journalist Pulitzer and Thompson zero in on Jorn Vandersloot, a wealthy young man suspected of killing two young women within 5 years to the day of each other. This true crime account delivers excellent and gripping reporting of the crimes and the manhunt. It's going to be a great show, Ronnie, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson.
Ron, Willie, thanks for having us.
Right. We're billing this show as The Last Word on Jorn Vandersloot, who certainly...
Somehow I doubt that.
Well, that's one of my questions, is this going to be the last word on that? But how's the book doing, given the fact that, the story has slipped out of the news?
The book's doing all right. We had hoped for a trial, then you get the wall-to-wall coverage, but he's right where he deserves to be.
Right. It's really interesting, given the intense media attention over the last couple of years. I'm just curious, why did you guys decide to do the book?
Lisa,
you're taking
one.
A risk. I know as a writer myself, you're taking a risk, because timing is everything.
Oh, yeah. No, the project started with Lisa, I guess, almost 5 years to the day before the first murder. She was hired by St. Martin's to write a book on the case, mm-hmm. and it got shelved, and 5 years later, I got a call from Lisa saying, hey, you want to go to Peru? Our boy surfaced again. And yeah, hell yeah, I want to go to Peru. That sounds like fun. So we went down there. We got together with the cops. For some reason, they took a shine to us, and we hung out with the actual police team, the investigative team, detectives who worked on the case. Right. And they just opened their doors to us. And it was just incredible. And it was because we were working on a book. We were working on something big, something long term. Right. We weren't looking for a sound bite.
That's right.
And they wanted their story told.
Right. Well, you said it was like 5 years ago where Lisa first got involved. And given the research, which is quite remarkable, you've got a lot of great material in this book, and I'm sort of envious as a writer on this sort of thing. So I would imagine that it took you that long, right, to get a real handle on the story and
it be really
able to put everything together and to get some of these interviews with all these diverse people from the family to police, associates, etc., right?
Yes. And in fact, I started off in Aruba not long after Natalie Holloway disappeared. Mm-hmm. And it was just an amazing, it was an amazing time down on the island. I was down there mm-hmm. at the time that they were doing all of the water searches for Natalie Holloway. So Dave Holloway mm-hmm. was down there on the pier every day, standing mm-hmm. at the edge of the pier, watching the boats go out and waiting for news. And it was really heart-wrenching because I think as a viewer watching from home, you see the footage on television and... you understand that this is a man looking for his daughter, when you're there and actually on the pier with him, and you can feel him on the one hand wanting to have news, but on the other hand mm-hmm. dreading any news, because any news would be bad news when you're pulling mm-hmm. a body from the water. So it was pretty intense. There were a lot of different police over the years that worked on the case down in Aruba, and a lot of different lawyers came on and off the case. And, of course, Jorn had supposedly two alleged accomplices who were, in the end, cleared. So there was that whole...
The Indian kids, right?
Exactly. And in their, their whole story as well, we had to report those. Each piece of the case was so interesting because everybody seemed to have an alibi, but then didn't have an alibi.
There were so many parallels between the two cases, too, both in Aruba and in Peru. In Aruba, you had the Calpo brothers, and in Peru, you had the two twins, the cab drivers, who helped him get down to Chile. So it was, you know, it was just amazing, you know, just day after day looking through this stuff. You're like, you know what, this is so similar to the other case.
Right. Well, I was talking to Willie, and you mentioned that they're Surinamese, right, brothers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Deepak Kapoor and Satish Kapoor.
Satish,
right. They disappeared, you know, from the story. And when I was researching the story and I was reading your book, they finally came back, and you said they were cleared. But then wasn't there any kind of connection at all to Jorn Vandersloot and Natalie Holloway?
Go ahead, Lisa.
No, it seems to me that the police, you know, in the end, were just left with this just big riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a mystery, as they say. And, you know, the three guys just told so many lies. I don't think in the end anybody was clear on what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, while Jorn was allowed to leave Aruba because he was a Dutch citizen, he was allowed to travel within the Netherlands. He was able to go back to Holland. The Kalper brothers, for years, weren't allowed to leave the island of Aruba.
Wow. Now, did you try to interview Jorn or the Kalper brothers?
Yes, we actually tried. You know, Jorn Vandersloot was really unwilling to do any kind of an interview without some sort of monetary promise. You know?
Right.
He wanted $1 million.
$1 million.
He's always working the angles. And so,
very Blagojevich.
I did speak with his mother, and, you know, in the very beginning it was so interesting because, you know, they were so convinced, both his mother and father were so convinced that their son was innocent, just being framed, and were very indignant and, in you know, very outraged that people were pointing the finger at him. Mm-hmm. You know, and it, as the story evolved, even up until the point where he was again arrested in Peru for his involvement in the Stephanie Flores case, his mother just refused to believe that her son could have had anything to do with such a violent type of a crime.
Right.
She's since come around, though, and she's publicly proclaimed that, you know, she's just washed her hands of him. She'll you know, keep him and send him a little money for his canteen funds now and then, but that's pretty much all she wants to do with him. She didn't attend the trial. She hasn't visited. And you were about to ask about the father.
He died of a heart attack, I believe, right?
Jorn was trying to shake his father. Well, he was selling a story to Fox News. Whether it was true or not remains, you know, unclear.
Yeah.
You know, voice experts had a hard time identifying the voices on the tapes. But he was he claimed to have had tapes of a conversation that he had on Skype with his father, where he and his father were discussing the whole cover-up and everything, and he was going to sell this tape to Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so shortly thereafter, the story comes out. Jorn's father finds out about it, and you know, just not long thereafter, he drops dead at 57 on a tennis court in Aruba.
Right. Well, you know, I'm always fascinated by the banality of evil. I remember when I was a kid, you know, the Eichmann trials and all that. How normal people look. And that's one of the reasons I was fascinated by Jorn. He looked like a, you know, like a normal kid, you know, good looking, and all that. But you, obviously, by your title, you've concluded that he's a monster, right? Give us some background on him. Like how does this kid become a monster? His parents seemed to be okay, but he turned out to be the way he did. And what did your research reveal about that?
That he was and always has been just a shiftless little weasel. He moved to his parents moved to Aruba when he was three or four years old. And he became very involved in Aruban culture. He learned the local Creole dialect, which is Papiamento. So he fit in. He would never be quite an island boy. And his parents were, you know, they were very stodgy. They were very Dutch, and so they didn't really fit in except with the other recent Dutch expatriates. And Jorn, you know, through the years he grew up a lot faster than his peers. He just shot up. I think they call it prepubescent puberty. And he became very sexually aggressive, physically aggressive, you know, really scary to be around. We've heard reports that he nearly beat one of his brothers to death. And so his parents I think more than to give him his freedom than to just, mm-hmm. you know, they really wanted to just separate him from the family unit. They moved mm-hmm. him into a guest house on their property that had mm-hmm. once been a maid's quarters. Mm-hmm. And from there, he was pretty much free to come and go as he pleased. And mm-hmm. he, well, you know, it sounds like he was a bright student, but he loved to gamble.
Was he popular?
He loved to party. And he mm-hmm. was just given the run of the island. You know, he wasn't mm-hmm. he wasn't very well supervised. And I mm-hmm. think he had some kind of, and still does, some sort of mental condition, maybe
right.
bipolar. You know, he's definitely a sociopath. He cares nothing right. for others.
Right. Did you talk to a psychologist that about, you know, how would you classify him?
Oh, we've talked to a lot of psychologists, and, you know,
he
ranged from sociopath to psychopath, but mm-hmm. we have his, and it's in our book, we have the full psychological report that they conducted on him down in mm-hmm. Peru, you know, shortly after his arrest.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It seems like a ticking time bomb, right?
Yeah, getting into his personality, though, when I first got into this, because I was working at Court TV when the Natalie Holloway story broke.
Right.
I was working on Catherine Cryer's show, and so we covered it extensively. And just mm-hmm. all the lies he told and how he's able to manipulate the police, I assumed he was some sort of criminal mastermind.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Aruba case, the deeper we got into it, the guy seems like a, you know, just almost a bumbling idiot.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, he drinks too much, he talks too much. This mm-hmm. latest murder was almost committed on videotape. You see him going in mm-hmm. and out of the room. They've got his passport Xerox down at the desk. He's definitely not a criminal mastermind, and master of three languages, he's certainly not. He doesn't speak any one language particularly well.
Now that's really interesting. Now, you're such a bumbling guy, so that sort of, you know, makes the question, corruption in the police, corruption on the island. Was there protection involved with him, or anything of that sort?
Exactly. That
may explain why he was able to walk free. And, you know, he confessed. How many times did he confess, right? And then retracted and all
14.
That sort of stuff. Right, right. So did the corruption play a big role?
Lisa, do you feel this one?
It's baffling to, when you really look at the case, to, you know, not only did Jeroen van der Sloot somehow, you know, there's some involvement with Natalie's disappearance, yet
mm-hmm.
they've never found a body. They've never mm-hmm. been able to figure out what happened to her. The island is very small. And then just recently they had the second disappearance and murder of a woman on the same island. And again, the police were just unable to connect the dots and arrest and mm-hmm. try the alleged killer. So you have to wonder, you know, what is going on inside the police department that makes them incapable of solving crime.
Right.
Yeah, I've got a right. quick question before we go to a station break, Ronnie.
Right. Go ahead.
You know, you guys have a very extensive background in investigative reporting. Can you comment on the caliber of the investigative procedures of the authorities down there in Aruba and Peru? Is it the same caliber, or is it compared to the American methods?
It's black and white with Aruba and Peru. The Aruban authorities, you know, God bless them, they did the best they could, but they completely bungled the case. It was the mm-hmm. polar opposite when we visited Aruba. I was expecting Peru. I was expecting, you know, just like this backwoods, you know, kind of the investigative team, you know, just mm-hmm. not real bright guys with hardly any equipment, and we met just the opposite. Juan Cayenne mm-hmm. Vargas, who led the team, was one of the most intelligent investigators I've ever met in my life. And they had not quite the sophistication that we have up here, but they had DNA, they had fingerprint analysis, they were doing tests on all the liquids they found in the hotel room, in the cars. They were doing a luminol test. They had pretty much everything we have. You know, they're
wow.
maybe 5 years behind us in technology, but, mm-hmm. you know, they've got the tools they need. And they right. presented a case that was just, the kid couldn't have beat it. You know, it almost
right.
makes sense that he pled guilty and just threw himself on the mercy of the court, as narcissistic
right.
as he is.
Let's take
yeah.
a break, Willie, and we'll get back to our guests and then Portrait of a Monster.
You bet. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Our very special guests this evening are Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, authors of Portrait of a Monster. Now back to Ron and our featured guests, Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson.
Right, Willie. And the subtitle is Jorn Vandersloot, A Murder in Peru, and the Natalie Holloway Mystery. I know, Lisa, you've got a website, www.lisapulitzer.com. How about you, Cole?
Oh, we also, Lisa and I share a website, pulitzerandthompson.com. Pulitzer, like the Pulitzer Prize, and Thompson with an H, .com.
Right. And the book's available on Amazon.
Oh,
and
of course.
I guess most of the traditional bookstores. How about internationally? We got a lot of international listeners.
You know, I'm not sure exactly how that works. I would think they'd purchase it on Amazon, but I'm not sure. I hope
right.
you can buy it.
Right. Well, they'll look, obviously, after this fascinating interview. And you're both on Facebook and Twitter, right? If our listeners want to keep up with you and some of your future projects.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you just Google Portrait of a Monster on Facebook, you can find us.
Great. On that.
We'd love to hear from you.
Great. Now, Lisa, I read where you thought at first Natalie's death was an accident.
When I first started investigating the case, mm-hmm. and I was, down on Aruba, it's just the way that the whole evening went down with Joran and Natalie, it didn't seem to me that there was any sort of premeditation involved in that Joran mm-hmm. did not seek somebody to murder that night.
Mm-hmm.
So in my first, sort of investigation of the case, I was of the belief that perhaps Natalie had she's a very tiny girl. She's 105 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
She was drinking and was not accustomed to drinking on the island. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, they were sun tanning, so she may have been dehydrated. And I was concerned that perhaps she's grew ill when she left the bar with him, and maybe mm-hmm. accidentally, she was either sick on the beach or she was dehydrated and sick, and Joran did not seek help. But as the story progressed and as he started to reveal himself and the type mm-hmm. of callous person that he was and the many stories that he started to tell, each one, slightly different in what, always the same how he left the bar with Natalie, but always slightly different as to what the outcome was, what happened to her. And mm-hmm. most telling was the one that where he confessed to an undercover reporter in the Netherlands that she had gone into some sort of a seizure, and he just left her on the beach. I started
right.
to realize that, something more sinister may have happened. But after the brutal, brutal murder of Stephanie Flores in Peru, and the way mm-hmm. that he literally just took out his rage and brutalized her, I started to realize at that point that perhaps something similar had befallen Natalie. There was some
right.
sort of a rejection. Something may have triggered him because he was a very angry guy, and he angered very easily. All of the psychological reports
right.
Written about him said that he just was almost like very immature for his age, and if somebody would
right.
do or say something that was not to his pleasing, he would become enraged.
Right.
So yeah,
it might just be me watching too many crime shows, but I've
uh-huh.
always been a little confused about what happened in Aruba.
Uh-huh.
Never been
uh-huh.
completely sure. My gut has told me he's the doer, but I really don't know. But when
right.
we went through the police reports and his confessions and talks with the police and even the off-the-record stuff that the cops shared with us, talking about how after he beat her within an inch of his life, he was pretty sure she was dead. Sounds
mm-hmm.
like he took a shower, went on
right.
a coffee run. At some point, he realizes she's still gurgling. She's still alive on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Calm as day, he picks a shirt up off the bed, the same shirt he's seen walking into the hotel wearing, and smothers her with it. And I don't know if it's just me, but it just seemed like a signature.
Right.
If I saw somebody lying on the floor, gurgling, just barely alive, but she could have been saved had paramedics been called, just picking up a shirt and smothering her, like it was just instinct. It
right.
told me that he'd probably done this before.
But it's not conclusive. I mean, there's no evidence of that. It's sort of like you figure this is the logical conclusion, given
personality. Yeah, no. You're absolutely right. You know, he could have done it all over the world. He could have done this many times, but there's one conviction, you know, one set of evidence that's utterly damning.
Did the police look for other possible victims?
They did. They did. And, you know, they went through Interpol and they, you know, went through law enforcement agencies all around the world. He's been to a lot of places. He traveled extensively.
Right. He was in Thailand with human sex trafficking, right.
And he was in Malaysia, and he was a big gambler. He got over to Asia, just would, you know, kind of island hop.
Was that why he was traveling like that? It wasn't for something nefarious. It was for gambling?
He was mainly going to gambling tournaments. But, you know, if he had an ulterior motive, you know, we'll probably never know.
Yeah, you describe him as an itinerant gambler, poker king, of all things. You know, well, what's the most money you think he's ever won that you know of?
It's hard to say. He never declared any of his money. He even bragged to the police, why declare your winnings? You know, if you're going to travel, it just makes it that much more trouble. He claimed to be a very successful gambler. He had gambling accounts on numerous sites. But he just—he seemed like he was constantly desperate for money, telling his parents he was in trouble. I need money to get bailed out of this or that, and whether he was in trouble or not, you know,
did the money he won, did that sustain his lifestyle? Where was his money coming from? Was he
Let's go back to Aruba. It's almost 5 years after the murder of Natalie Holloway. You're on contacts Natalie Holloway's mother's attorney, John Q. Kelly. And says, look, you know, for $25,000, I'll sell the location, for $250,000, I'll sell the location of her body. And so he gets a down payment of $25,000. He gives a bogus location of the body, a property where, he said it was buried in the foundation of a house, but a house hadn't been built there when he said it was. He takes the $25,000 down to Peru to enter a gambling tournament, and before the gambling tournament even starts, he's broke. I mean, that's how quickly the guy goes through money.
Wow.
So he never seemed like a successful gambler to me.
Right. Well, you know, Aruba is such a small place, and, you know, there's not that many people, so, you know, gossip is probably rampant. I find it hard to believe that we know nothing about Natalie Holloway, what happened to her. That just, you know, baffles my mind. That's one of the reasons why I'm really...
Okay, let's go to a more recent case, the Robin Gardner case. You know, they said it could never happen. A person could never go missing in Aruba. Mm-hmm. The waters are too clear. They're too shallow. There's no sharks, this and that. You know, the island, you know, you can scour it with dogs. And if somebody buried a body or tossed a body in the water, you'd find it. Robin Gardner, you know, that's what, a two-year-old case? Another blonde down there with an American, you know, on vacation, disappears, never seen again.
Wow. Well, the mother... I mean, it must just be total anguish for her, day in and day out, right? Not knowing what happened to your daughter. And you interviewed the family, right?
I interviewed, actually, Dave Holloway. I spoke briefly with Beth Holloway. At the time that I was seeking to interview her, she was way too distraught to speak, you know, in terms of a book or with anybody about her daughter in such final terms. But Dave Holloway, who was down there, you know, for months on end trying to find out what happened to his daughter. He literally searched, when I tell you, every inch of that island. He was in, you know, digging out old, defunct wells. He was following any lead that he could possibly get for his daughter, and I just cannot, to this day, understand how she could just disappear without any sort of, you know,
physical
the only
evidence.
Answer is that somebody took her off that island and she is no longer, you know, either she was buried somewhere else or she was taken out to sea, because there is absolutely no way with the amount of searching that was done on that island that if her body was still there, they wouldn't have found it.
And he is just the sweetest man in the world. And since the Flores murder in Peru, he and Ricardo Flores, the father of Stephanie Flores, have been in touch, and they seem to have kind of been, you know, leaning on each other. Right. They've formed a bond.
Right. Well, have they stopped looking for the question, what happened?
Earlier Natalie Holloway's father, Dave, had Natalie officially declared dead. The mother, Beth Holloway Twitty, was initially opposed to it, but she finally ceded and thought it was, you know, the right thing to do, because there were, it was a small estate, but it could go to the education of, you know, the other the other siblings.
Right. And there's no further effort to try to get Yoren to tell us all he knows about what happened to the...
No, not at all. John Q. Kelly is very determined to get Yoren back to the United States, possibly, you know, before he even finishes serving his sentence, to stand charges on the federal charges here for wire fraud and extortion. You know,
right. So he might make a deal and reveal what he knows.
Yeah, they're
right?
hoping to briefly extradite him to the United States, try him before witnesses get old, memories fade, people die, get a conviction here, then send him down to Peru, back to Peru, where he could finish out the entire sentence or do have, you know, the Peruvian part of the sentence there and the rest in the United States.
Yeah.
Whether
Ron,
he'll be successful in that, I'm not sure.
The problem is, Ron, is that Yoren has told so many stories that at this point it's hard to really be able to sift through what is, you know, what is real, what is, you know, what is from his, you know, his
I don't think they expect to get the truth out of him on this. It's kind of like trying Al Capone on, you know, tax evasion charges. You know, they're getting him on something else, but they're serious charges. They're federal charges, you know, with serious time behind them.
Right. Yeah, ironically, they may be hoping that the Yoren's lawyers get something on appeal, right, because they're trying to get him down to, I think, I read where it's like 9 or 10 years.
Yes. In Peru.
Maybe not that small an amount, but, you know, he's probably looking at about 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Right, and
he's a young guy. He's about 24 years old, so, you know, he's still got half of his life ahead of him if he gets released in 15 years, which is terrifying.
Right. Willie, let's take another station break, and we'll continue with this fascinating discussion.
You bet. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly. Our special guests this evening are Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, authors of Portrait of a Monster. Now back to our guests and Ron.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with our guests, Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson. And I highly recommend their book. It's a great read, a tremendous study of a real monster. And it's something that I highly recommend on this. Now, getting back to Yoren, what can you tell us about Stephanie Flores Ramirez that we didn't pick up in the newspapers? Anything new that your research uncovered?
Just, we flushed her out as a three-dimensional character. You know, somebody's daughter. She just finished college. She'd had her whole life ahead of her. You know, just the stories about when she was a child, and she was very much a tomboy. And her father was a very famous race car driver. He did the rally races, the Inca del Caminos,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
I think he'd won that race twice. And just the behind-the-scenes story of him, of her being the navigator in one of those cars. He'd put a uniform on her, put a helmet on her, just disguise her so nobody would know that he was driving with a girl. And he would drive with his own daughter on these terribly dangerous races. He owned a circus for a while. And his daughter, at 3 years old, rode out into the big top on the back of a circus. On the back of an elephant, and just a wonderful, wonderful family, and they completely let us into their lives, and made her real. And you know, there were so many stories flying around at the time of the murder. They found amphetamines in her system. We discovered through the autopsy that she had had one of those gastric bands put in her stomach because she was having weight problems. You know, which explained, you know, mild amphetamines in the system. She was trying to lose weight. She was trying to curb her appetite. I think the press was looking for something sinister there where nothing existed. She was just a victim, just another person who was manipulated by a guy she just thought was a nice tourist boy hanging out in the casino, just like Natalie Holloway 5 years before.
Right. It seemed that the woman seemed to be attracted to Yoren. Is that true?
He's a lady killer.
Right.
Personality? I guess literally.
Sociopath? Charming.
All of the above.
I think what's intriguing about him is that, you know, he's someone who's educated and speaks several languages, so you can't, you know, he doesn't look like the, you know, the sleazy guy in the trench coat who's going to, you know, take you into an alley and strangle you. He's very charming.
Yeah.
He seems, you know, he comes off as being educated and courtly. And so you're very unsuspecting in his presence, which I think is part of his, part of the danger.
And it, yeah, it's a cautionary tale for women, single women, or
traveling
teenagers
right?
traveling abroad. You know, that the nice, sophisticated guy who's well-traveled and seems utterly harmless, who invites you, you know, to a bar and separates you from your friends, you know, might actually be out there to kill you.
That's right. And I understand that Mrs. Holloway has made it her one of her missions in life, right, to educate, you know, other families about these dangers.
Exactly,
oh, yeah.
Exactly. And I can't, you know, you have to give the woman so much credit for being able to move forward, you know, with mm-hmm. this, you know, this horrible unanswered question about her daughter.
Yeah. You know, even though she, just a quick one, Ronnie, though he remains in a solitary cell in Lima, he still gets countless letters from admirers, females. I mean, what makes this guy so attractive, even though he's in a
slammer? That just happens with criminals. I don't understand it. We've all seen the phenomena. I, you know, worked on a book on Scott Peterson. He was getting constant, you know, marriage proposals in the mail. Mm-hmm. You know, even guys as creepy as Manson get these groupies.
Right.
And I don't know what's wrong with these people. And you're on, I guess his most famous supporter was that woman Mary Hamer, who was a radiologist from Florida, who was floating.
They described her as the guardian angel. I was going to ask you about her. They call her the guardian angel.
Yeah, I don't want to say anything bad about the woman. I've never met her. I don't know what her motives are. I just thought the whole thing was a little strange.
Well, is she supplying him with money?
I understand that she, you know, put tens of thousands of dollars into his legal expenses, and then she later complained to the press that they were spent on things that she didn't expect them to be spent on. She thought the money was going to be used for bail, and she wanted her money back. And it's, you know, being reported that she's currently embroiled in a lawsuit with Euron's attorney.
Oh, wow.
She is saying misappropriated the funds. So I don't know. That's just a whole other side story.
Right. Well, when he did flee Peru there for a time, and I was always amazed because he was carrying a book of Al Capone. I was wondering if
Al
Capone.
What
did that tell us? What
I don't know. He had some Benoit balls with him too. What does that tell us? He had some prickly foot powder. He had what else did he have? He had some strange stuff on him.
I mean,
the cab driver said that he threw a bag of weed out the window when they were crossing one of the checkpoints.
Yeah. Well, was he really interested? Was he really getting involved in sex trafficking in Thailand? I've seen, you know, those tapes, and they're just fascinating. He's sitting there like some kind of kingpin.
Well, the guy was into making money and manipulating the media. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, maybe the media kind of set him up and he kind of went along with it because there was always some sort of financial exchange that went on, and Euron would do just about anything on camera for money. So whether that was true or whether it was staged, not really sure, but it was never proven conclusively that he was involved in sex trafficking. I imagine he would have wanted to be, but...
Right. Well, he confessed. And then recanted again, right?
Oh, yes. He said it was cold.
Over and over.
Right, on that. And I saw him, you know, sweating profusely when he was getting... Did he show any remorse? Or is there... You know, he was trying to... I thought he was trying to look a little bit more humbler than he was in the past. But do you think there's any remorse at all in what he did outside, you know, for his victim, not just for himself?
No, I think there's just anger that he's being persecuted.
Oh, yeah, he's just angry that he's in jail. And he's already complaining because they had the gall to move him from his cell.
Right. They moved him from a prison in Lima to one about 18 miles away that's not as comfortable. And
it's a serious prison.
Right. And so he got 28 years. And He's not going to spend 28 years in jail, is he?
No, they have a parole system that's much more generous than we have even here. Will be lucky if he serves half his sentence.
Right. Now, given the corruption, I understand that Peru has a serious corruption problem in the prisons, what I've been reading. Is there a possibility that he could weasel his way out a long time earlier than his sentence?
Corruption goes both ways. Corruption could also get him killed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, but
right.
If he comes up with enough money, the problem is at this point he has no source.
Wow.
He's not a guy who could just silently slink out of prison. You know, even if he were to be let free, he is one of the most recognizable faces on the planet. He is 6 foot, you know, 7. He stands out in a crowd. And I think one of the reasons he moved to Asia after the Natalie Holloway case was he thought he could just disappear and just blend into another society. Everyone everywhere he went knew who he was. So, you know, I don't think he's going to be able to cut a deal. I don't think he's going to be able to be released without anyone noticing. You know, the whole world is watching this guy.
Right.
And Peru knows that. And they did an incredible job of investigating the case and then prosecuting the case. And, you know, it's a win-win situation for Peru, and they're not going to screw this up.
Right. On that. And the chances of him being extradited to the U.S., what's your feeling on that?
Well, they are 100%. It's just a matter of when. Is it going to be after he finishes serving his sentence in Peru, or are they going to let him come sometime sooner, stand trial, and then be sent back to Peru? But either way, those charges are not going away. And he's facing, I believe, 25 years on that in a federal penitentiary here, likely in Alabama, where he's not going to be a popular guy.
Right, so he could be a very, very old man before he has any chance of seeing the daylight again, right?
That's the hope.
Right, on that. And so what does Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson do for an encore after this book? 5 years on the hunt for this story?
Oh, I've been kind of shifting base into history. I'm doing something a little different. I'm working on a history of northern Manhattan. Everybody focuses on downtown, and I've gotten very involved in the history of my own neighborhood, really.
Well, that's really going from one edge to the other, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I can sleep a little easier. There's no nightmares with this one.
That's right. How about you, Lisa?
I just finished a book with Karen Gravano called Mob Daughter, which is about it's the story of sort of her experience growing up with Sammy the Bull as her dad.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have you, right, we're going to have Karen on the show, and we invite you to come on the show, too, June 15th. We look forward to that show. It's going to be a good... And I just got a copy of the book. I love the cover.
I know. It's a great cover. Great cover.
Right.
And it's really
thank
a good
you so
read.
Much. Excuse me. Go ahead.
I said it's a good read as well.
Right. I can hardly wait to get into it. And we run out of time, and we really appreciate having you on the show to talk about this fascinating subject. It's the last word on Jorn Vandersloot. And the name of the book is Portrait of a Monster. And Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson are the authors, and I highly recommend it. Willie recommends it as well.
Absolutely.
And thank you again for being on
the
show. Good
Willie,
luck with
Ryan,
your
best.
Book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. Well,
Willie?
Hey, Ronnie. Yeah, thanks for that. And again, thanks to our featured guests, Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson. It was a fascinating interview, and we were delighted to have them on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our interview tonight?
Well, I think this is about the last word on Jorn Vandersloot. We have the two authors that have done the definitive study on him, and I guess the only question is whether when he'll make it to the United States. He's
well, I think jail. Yeah, you know, jailhouse justice might just do him in. That's probably what might happen. But in any event. We'll try to keep an eye on this story. This guy was a cunning killer man, manipulative, and I just wonder how many guys like him are out there. It was a great book. Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson wrote. It offers a chilling portrait of this cold-blooded killer.
How many guys are out there, Willie? I hope they stay away from me.
Well, anyway, I urge all our listeners out there around the world to go out and buy their book. You won't want to put it down. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beats Gangster Nickname of the Month segment. Hey, Ronnie, remember this guy, the Genovese family's Vincent the Chin Gigante? The Chin went to prison in 1997 and died in the slammer in 2005. Vincent the Gin Gigante was also known as the Odd Father, or not, whose crazy man strolls in Greenwich Village in his pajamas kept him out of jail for decades. The Chin feigned mental illness for years to camouflage his position as one of the nation's most influential and dangerous mafia leaders. Quite the actor, Ronnie.
Yeah, imagine being sane and trying, having to spend 10 years feigning mental illness, right?
You've been doing that for years, buddy.
Right, they called him the Odd Fella and they called him the Enigma in the bathrobe because he walked around for like 10 years in a bathrobe mumbling to himself. It took him about 10 years before they finally got him to be declared mentally competent. But it's really interesting background on this guy. I mean, he had five brothers, and one of them was a priest. You know, he went straight. And, you know, and when Gotti was convicted in 92, they say that the Chin became the biggest and most powerful gangster in New York City. So this guy was no lightweight, and a very interesting story.
Yeah.
But, right, and he died in prison.
Yeah, I tell you, what a strange character, and smart as a weasel that guy was. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for April the 12th. Our guest will be Chris Kyle, author of the best-selling book titled American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. history. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We'd also like to remind you, Ron and I will appear on the popular Chit Chat Cafe with Nancy in the next hour just after this broadcast. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Shepsik and yours truly, Will Hareb. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we'd like to thank you for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Shepsik and myself, Will Hareb, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.